Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. A landmark legal victory in northwestern Ontario could end clear-cutting. A former corrections officer has finally settled his 23-year-old human rights discrimination case, and Aboriginal children are overrepresented in the child welfare system, and a report on Aboriginal child welfare in Ontario calls for many changes to the system, and the most powerful words come from children. Later in Bomsida, hear how a 10-year-old BC girl is fighting back against pipelines. And the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards next round of voting is coming out and they want you to vote. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. A northwestern Ontario First Nation has won a long-standing legal battle that could end clear-cutting in its territory. The ruling came down from the Ontario Superior Court of Justice August 16th. Grassy Narrows First Nation welcomed the decision by Madam Justice Marianne Sanderson to protect the rights promised to the Anishinaabe by the province. The First Nation had been fighting for more than a decade to stop clear-cutting in their traditional territory in the Treaty 3 area. Joseph Phobister was one of the complainants and is a hunter and trapper. He says it means consultation will have to happen.
Government and industry will have to consult First Nations in a meaningful way before they decide to harvest or exercise any kind of industrial activity on First Nations territories.
Phobister says the court case was just one of the many steps the community has taken to fight clear-cutting, and he says he also saw firsthand the impacts of clear-cutting.
Martin was the first sign that was the first thing we noticed were disappearing from our trap line. Martin is a weasel-like animal that is easy to trap and easy to process. And the latest thing we've noticed is the moose on our hunting areas are disappearing. The cause is due to clear harvesting.
Phobister adds the community hopes industry and government will review the court decision and change their ways. Annapolis Valley First Nation Chief Brian Tony wants the name of Cornwallis River in Nova Scotia changed. The Mi'kmaq chief told CBC News that the name of the river is derogatory because it's named after a man who handed out money rewards for taken or killed Mi'kmaq in 1749, which was during a war with the Mi'kmaq. The First Nation has passed a resolution calling for the name change. The chief said he would like to see the river given back its original Mi'kmaq name, which translates in English to narrow river. A couple of months ago, the Halifax School Board voted to change the name of Cornwallis Junior High. A corrections officer has finally had his discrimination case settled. His complaint was against the Ministry of Community Safety and Corrections, and he took his complaint to the Human Rights Commission of Ontario. Michael McKinnon brought his discrimination complaint forward 23 years ago when he worked at the Metro Toronto East Detention Centre. Barbara Hall is the Chief Commissioner of the Human Rights Commission of Ontario. She says as a result of settling the case, the Commission and the Ministry of Community and Safety have entered into a charter relationship to address issues in the system.
It's something that is agreed to by two deputy ministers from the government and me as the chief commissioner. And it agrees that we will work together to address a range of issues related to bias and discrimination within that ministry. We'll work on them together, and the commission will report annually on the progress that we're making.
Hall adds the details of McKinnon's settlement are not public. The Assembly of First Nations has rejected criticisms of the National Education Panel. 230 First Nations from Ontario, Quebec, and Saskatchewan pulled out of the panel last week. The leadership seemed worried about future one-size-fits-all education legislation. National Chief Sean Atleo released a statement to the Canadian press and refuted that the organization was engaged in developing legislation. The National Education Panel was announced by Atleo last December. The province of BC has injected some extra cash into the Industry Training Authority aimed at exploring employment barriers for Aboriginal people in the province. ITA received $200,000 on top of its $2.2 million in funding. The Journal of Commerce reports ITA is to undertake a one-year study to find ways to eliminate barriers to trades training completion and employment. The study will also focus on increasing First Nation participation in apprenticeships. The research project starts this month and wraps up September 2012. Ways to improving child welfare for Aboriginal children are being looked at in Ontario and Saskatchewan. Recently in Ontario, a report on the status of Aboriginal child welfare in Ontario was prepared for the Ministry of Children and Youth Services. The report came with a list of recommendations aimed at giving First Nations more control over Aboriginal child welfare. Children and Youth Services Minister Laurel Broughton says the ministry has already made some improvements and will be looking at more.
We will be looking at all of the recommendations. The ministry is examining them, taking a look at how we can build upon many of the interministerial collaborations that we have in place and really seek to move forward. So it's a very active file, and folks are very much absorbing the very thoughtful recommendations.
In Saskatchewan, News Talk 650 reports the province signed two letters of understanding with the Federation of Saskatchewan Indian Nations and the Métis Nation. The letters are to pledge to work towards making changes to transform the child welfare system. Opposition to the Enbridge Northern Gateway Pipeline has not diminished. It has grown with the powerful voice of a 10-year-old Sliman girl. Takai Blaney doesn't want to see a pipeline run through the land that she loves so much. She's written a song, Shallow Waters, which speaks to the devastation of oil spills. Plus, last month, Takai went to the Enbridge head office to deliver her message, but she wasn't allowed in.
I didn't think I was scary or anything like that, but I had Greenpeace with me in the media, and then later on we found out that they're not allowed to bring cameras in there. But just wanted to talk to them and tell them message, but you see companies like this, they're not open to hearing messages that people have to say.
Takai says she was disappointed that she couldn't deliver her message, but she was happy that she was able to deliver her message with the Yenke Dene Alliance at the Enbridge AGM in Calgary earlier this year. And Takai also encourages others to speak out.
You have a voice. Let it be heard. Let the gift be shared.
Takai says she's also opposed to a new proposal to put in a pipeline to Texas, and she says companies just don't understand what they're putting at risk. Inuit hunters in Iqaluit have celebrated their first traditional bowhead whale hunt in about a century. CBC reports two dozen hunters were part of the expedition to kill the 14-meter-long whale August 15th. The whale was estimated to be about 74 tons and could feed hundreds of people. The hunters and community members harvested skin and blubber. Elders say the harvest signifies a return to traditional whaling that has nearly been forgotten for about 100 years. The Aboriginal People's Music Choice Awards has all its nominees in place, and the first round of voting is done. The second round starts August 25th. Manager of Operations Derek McCorrister says there's a lot of newcomers to watch for.
There's been a lot of eye-openers, I guess you can say, or diamonds in the roughs kind of thing. We have like artists like, there's a hip-hop artist from Quebec called Samian, who does a collaboration with Cashton. That particular artist wasn't on our radar. Some local artists as well too. Ali Fontaine has been a newcomer as well. Artists from the north as well. Artists in the United States. So you know, there's a lot of groups out there that you know we try to target, but there's a lot of exceptional talent out there, and we're happy that they've submitted to our awards.
The hardware will be handed out in November in Winnipeg. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
We've had lots of time now to make up our minds now. Time for Indo.
Atlas looks like change to me from ceremony. Joseph Phobister is a trapper and a hunter from Grassy Narrows First Nation and was one of the complainants in a Superior Court case. He hunts and traps in his territory, but over the past decade, he's noticed many changes, not good changes, due to clear-cutting. The community has loudly voiced its opposition to clear-cutting in their traditional territory in the Treaty 3 area in Ontario. Recently, the community won its long legal battle to stop clear-cutting. In a nutshell, Madam Justice Marianne Sanderson found that Ontario does not have the power to take away treaty rights and also promised to protect those rights. Now here's hunter-trapper Joseph Phobister to tell us about the court case and his observations over the past 10 years.
Our case has taken 10 years to get it to where it is today. We got a decision today, or yes, we got the notice yesterday that the decision was made, and we got a copy of it, and it's a very important win for us.
So what happened?
Well, we have to review the decision carefully, and the government and industry will have to consult First Nations in a meaningful way before they decide to harvest or exercise any kind of industrial activity on First Nations territories.
But what prompted the court case?
The court case is one of many actions we've been doing. The blockade was one, that the court case was another. Also entered into a process with Ontario, and the court case is just one of the steps we decided to do to advance our what we believe is the right thing to do.
And what has your role been in all of this?
My role, I'm one of the trappers in the litigation. I saw that trap lines were being decimated by clear-cut logging. Didn't like what was happening, and we just, you know, action needed to be taken.
And so since this was launched more than 10 years ago, and when you were out trapping and saw these things, what exactly did you see?
Clear-cut logging really has a devastating impact on the ability for, you know, to exercise our constitutionally protected right to hunt and trap. And, you know, clear-cut logging is just not the way to go. You know, it does a lot of harm to the environment. There's contaminants, you know, that are created through clear-cut logging.
So what were you hunting and trapping that you didn't have too much access to after the clear-cut through the territory?
Marking was the first sign that we, was the first thing we noticed. We're disappearing from our trap line. Marking is a weasel-like animal that is easy to trap and easy to process. And the latest thing we noticed is the moose on our hunting areas are disappearing. The cause is due to clear-cut harvesting.
And then what about harvesting? Was there particular things that you were harvesting that you couldn't no longer, or other community members?
Well, at the rate that the environment is being devastated, it's likely that the medicinal plants and berries and other things that we enjoy will disappear if we didn't do anything.
So what are you hoping for with this, the victory with this court case?
Well, we're hoping that government and industry will look at the decision carefully and change their ways. I think the decision was the right thing. You know, we always said that they're acting illegally. And the judge just reaffirmed what we've been saying all along.
That was hunter-trapper Joseph Phobister from Grassy Narrows First Nation in northwestern Ontario. After 23 years, Corrections Officer Michael McKinnon has finally settled his discrimination case to the Human Rights Commission of Ontario. Barbara Hall is Chief Commissioner of the Human Rights Commission of Ontario.
This is a case that we've been involved with for many years. Mr. McKinnon filed a complaint 23 years ago alleging discrimination against him in his role as a corrections officer at the Metro Toronto East Detention Center. The complaint was filed with the Human Rights Commission, and it's been at the Human Rights Tribunal for many, many years. Mr. McKinnon sought certain remedies for himself and his wife to be able to return to work in a in a safe place. And the commission intervened seeking certain public benefits. And just recently, Mr. McKinnon settled his complaint, and that the details of that settlement are not public. And the commission, to deal with the public interest issues, has entered into a charter relationship with the Ministry of Corrections, where they've acknowledged there are some problems and will work with the commission to address them over the next few years.
Okay, I said a few questions come to mind, and but first, what is a chartered relationship?
This is a relationship between the commission and the government to address issues of discrimination and bias within the Ministry of Corrections. It's something that is agreed to by two deputy ministers from the government and me as the chief commissioner. And it agrees that we will work together to address a range of issues related to bias and discrimination within that ministry. We'll work on them together, and the commission will report annually on the progress that we're making.
Okay, and what kind of discrimination did Mr. McKinnon face while he worked?
The discrimination that was alleged was name-calling, harassment, really a poisoned environment for him, an environment in which he felt unsafe and unable to continue to do his job as the result of behavior from other employees, and the failure of the system to address those issues when he raised them.
So why did it take 23 years to address this?
Well, during this period, a lot of work has been done. It was at the tribunal. There was an adjudicator, William Hubbard, who during those 20-plus years made many orders for things to happen in the Ministry of Corrections. Frankly, they didn't happen. And so it kept coming back to the tribunal, and they kept, Mr. Hubbard kept being unhappy, and he would make other orders, and the change never occurred in the way he had seen. He made fantastic recommendations to deal with racial profiling, but the change didn't happen within the ministry. And some of that, as we found, is a function of things being imposed from outside, there being resistance within the organization. What's different about the charter is that we now have the leadership in the government, two deputy ministers, acknowledging that there are these issues and they're going to take responsibility to address them. And we have done similar kinds of work with police services in the area of education, where that kind of ownership of the problems and the solutions sometimes creates some change that doesn't flow when things are imposed externally.
That was Barbara Hall, Chief Commissioner of the Human Rights Commission of Ontario. Now here's Eagle and Hawk with What If We Could.
Spoken. What if I knew hearts
John Bokash is the former Anishinaabeg Nation Grand Council Chief, and he's been advocating for changes in the child welfare system for Aboriginal families. He's currently the Aboriginal Advisor to the Minister of Children and Youth Services in Ontario. He has prepared a report for the ministry, which looks at flaws in the system as well as recommendations. Now here's John Bokash.
I worked as a special advisor, an Aboriginal advisor, to the Minister of Child and Youth Services in Ontario. Since about, I guess it was April of 2010 until July the 6th of this year. And part of my job was to provide various levels of advice to the minister, but the biggest part of the job was to provide a report at the end of my term to allow the minister to have a different look at what might be some solutions to some of the issues that are involved with children in care, and specifically Aboriginal children in care in Ontario. And part of the whole situation is that more and more money is being spent on the child and family services, but there's the success is not growing at all. So lots of money with very little success. So it really begs a different way of looking at things. So that's really where my report came in, is to provide some different ideas for the minister, for the ministry to work on in the coming year or two to make some changes to the overall effectiveness of child and family services, particularly for Aboriginal children.
I had heard you refer to the large amount of Aboriginal children in foster care as the Millennium Scoop.
Yes. Now, that's a term that has, I believe it came from a paper that was done by a university professor. I don't remember her name now, but it came around that it was being used a fair bit and by people who are in the system. So I made use of that term in my paper as well, that we had the 60s scoop, which everybody knows about, and it was a whole process set up to bring children out of the First Nation environment, to put them into an urban environment, and to take them into an environment that wasn't Aboriginal. And it was just a terrible situation that happened in the 60s, where people were adopted out of their communities, adopted out of the country, and now they're trying to find their way back. And what's happening right now is that there's a huge number of children that are now in the system of foster care and of being adopted and so on, And so the numbers now are almost as great as they were back in the 60s. And so so there's a huge problem happening.
And while I was reading your report, I also found that you're also recommending a task force for urban Aboriginal children. And you want to tell us about that?
Yes. There's a huge number of our people now that live in urban areas. The numbers are difficult to really nail down because not everybody identifies themselves as Native. But I would think that we're probably greater than 60% of Aboriginal people live in the urban setting. And what happens is that unless there's a link to their culture and the way that they do things, because even though they're in an urban setting, they're still Native people. They still have their original culture, their original language, original spirituality. And often there's no link to that culture when they're in the urban setting. And so so what we're doing is we're losing touch with a whole number of people and children that are in urban areas. And then we can also, I guess, compound that with the idea that when we think about urban settings, that there's lots of facilities for people. Well, there is more facilities in the urban area, but it's not always the kind of things that look after Aboriginal people and Aboriginal children. So what I wanted to do with that task force was to bring it all together and to look at what the requirements are of children, particularly Aboriginal children, no matter where they live. And then that also would link the their home First Nation, because their home First Nation is still the responsible for them. And even though they don't have enough resources to look after every person, there's still that link that has to be kept. So I just wanted to kind of bring all that together and just to say, yes, there is an issue. Yes, here's some solutions, and bring all of the strong players together to view that process.
So along with recommendations for the Urban Aboriginal Youth or Child Task Force and the Band Rep Program, what are some of your other key recommendations?
Well, I think one of the recommendations that I think a great deal of is the whole aspect of moving toward First Nation Aboriginal authority to take over responsibility for children that are First Nation children, and part of it really goes back to the Constitution under Section 35 that states that, you know, what basically things that we've always done in terms of governance should remain and are part of who we are, that we never gave up the right to look after our children. So there are several organizations, the Union of Ontario Indians, Treaty 3, the Akwesasne First Nation, are developing laws for child protection. And these laws will come forward as a governance authority. So what I'm saying to the provincial government is start to work on a tripartite table right now with the federal and the provincial governments and the First Nation governments to see how this can be enacted in a seamless way.
That was Don Bokash, Aboriginal advisor to the Minister of Youth and Children's Services in Ontario. To view the report we were discussing, go to the Anishinaabeg Nation's website, and the report is in the Social Services Program tab under What's New. Takaya Blaney has a very powerful voice at the tender age of 10. The Sulayaman girl has been using her voice to speak out about Enbridge's Northern Gateway Pipeline. She doesn't want to see the pipeline go from Edmonton to Kitimat, and Takaya wrote a song, Shallow Waters, which speaks to the devastation of oil spills.
Well, Shallow Waters is about a future when oil spill happens, and I wrote it because they have a Northern Gateway Pipeline, and it's proposed to go from the tar sands of Alberta to Kitimat, BC, and this is super dangerous for a coast, for the ecosystem, for the First Nations culture. And I tried to bring this song to Enbridge, except they wouldn't let me through the front lobby. But because of this proposal, it's putting everything at risk. And we've had this culture for thousands of years, and they're just trying to put it at risk for an oil pipeline, which is really ridiculous. So
besides bringing your song Shallow Waters to Enbridge last month, what else did you want to tell them?
Well, I wanted to tell them that they should stop building all these pipelines and things like that, because this is our environment, it's our earth, and it's not like we have, like, a second one. We're living on it, and you can't keep trashing it, and you can't keep polluting it, and you can't keep putting these oil pipelines and putting all these people and these animals and these ecosystems at risk, because people's lives are being at risk just for the sake of money. And
Takaya, why do you think they didn't let you in?
I didn't think I was scary or anything like that, but I had Greenpeace with me in the media, and then later on we found out that they're not allowed to bring cameras in there. But I just wanted to talk to them and tell them the message. But you see, companies like this, they're not open to hearing messages that people have to say.
Especially young women. And how did you feel when they wouldn't let you in or anything or respond?
I was super disappointed because I'd been waiting for that for a really long time. But the Yankee Dene from Alliances, they, in May, they flew me up to Calgary to speak at the MJGM, so that was really amazing. And they are just really generous. They're really inspirational. And so I got to speak at the MJGM, so it was really cool. So,
So how did you get into speaking out about the pipeline?
I'm homeschooled, and I've been studying about otters, and I just love the environment. I love observing it, and we live on a mountain, so we get to go on a lot of walks and things like that a lot. And then this newspaper article came out about the Northern Gateway Pipeline, and I wanted to do something about it, and I had an idea of making a song about it, so now I have Shallow Waters, and I entered Shallow Waters later on into David Suzuki's songwriting contest, and that really urged me on to do more things. And so now I'm singing for St. James and Bella, and I'm spreading the word about the pipeline, and yeah, it's just pretty amazing.
It is most amazing. And do you think that you're going to continue on this path?
I think so, and I'm pretty sure. And there's also this other proposal to have a pipeline that goes to Dallas, Texas. So that's equally dangerous. Mm-hmm. So it's just companies that don't understand what they're putting at risk here. And they just don't understand at all.
Do you have a message for people out there, Takaya?
You have a voice. Let it be heard. You have a gift. Share it.
That was 10-year-old Takaya Blaney from the Sliaman Nation. She was discussing her opposition to the proposed Northern Gateway Pipeline. Now here's the song we were talking about, Shallow Waters.
Shallow waters, I can't see your clear waves lapping at my feet. Lifeless ocean, black, not blue. I didn't help but deep down I knew. Shallow waters I used to see, dolphins playing in front of me, the seaweed swaying, keeping time, tidal rhythms, laugh not cry. Oh, 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 why do tears fall from the sky? Oh, remember.
The first round of voting for the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards has wrapped up. Now it's on to round two of voting. Derek McCorrister is the manager of operations, and he'll tell us about the awards, which includes a slew of new artists this year.
Well, this year's awards are going really well right now. Presently, we are in round one of voting for the 2011 nominees. So basically, it started in July 15th, and round one ends on Thursday, August 18th at midnight. So you have until midnight to cast your votes for round one. Basically, you're selecting the nominees for the final round of voting, and you know the nominees will obviously. We have another round starting in August 25th when we announce our nominees, and we will then. Open up another round of voting to select the winners who will be taking home some hardware come November.
So how many artists have been submitted for the award so far?
This year we had approximately about 134 artists submit to the awards from, you know, all across North America and numerous categories. This year we adjudicated 22 categories. So right now all the artists are in the running in the various categories. We also introduced last year industry voting, where industry representatives across North America will log in and cast their votes in certain industry categories. So, and that's taking place at this time right now, too. But there is also a public vote going on, which is where they would, anyone can sign up to become a member and cast their vote in the various genre categories and single of the year category. And once we close voting on Thursday, we'll be able to tally up and determine the amount of nominees we have. We in years past, we roughly averaged around 70 to 80 nominees in the various categories, so we're hoping for more of the same this year.
And are there any newcomers to watch for?
Yeah, there's a lot of newcomers that, a lot of artists that, you know, weren't on our radar when we're out, trying to get submissions for the awards. You know, we have, obviously, we have a large list of artists that we want to ensure that they submit to the awards, but there's been a lot of eye-openers, I guess you can say, or diamonds in the rough kind of thing. We have, like, artists like, there's a hip-hop artist from Quebec called Samian, who does a collaboration with Cashton. That particular artist wasn't on our radar. Some local artists as well, too. Ali Fontaine has been a newcomer as well. Artists from the north as well. Artists in the United States. So, you know, there's a lot of groups out there that, you know, we try to target, but there's a lot of exceptional talent out there, and we're happy that they've submitted to our awards.
With with a lot of the newcomers you're talking about, are there any specific genres that they fall into, or like, is there any trends there?
Well, a lot of obviously the new artist category, which is an industry category, we look at, you know, some of the artists that are taking that step into, you know, recording. We had a number of drum groups submit from the East Coast and from the United States as well too, which you know, were definitely a surprise. We also had, mostly it's coming down to country, folk acoustic categories where a lot of artists have been, you know, submitting to. Ghost Keeper is one of them as well, too. Genevieve Fisher. There's a few artists there that, you know, we think that are, you know, just on the cusp of, you know, jumping into mainstream. And, you know, we're hoping that our awards will help them achieve their goal.
Okay, well, it sounds really exciting. And when and where will the hardware be handed out?
Well, the hardware, the first night is called the RBC Oshiki Awards Night, which will be November 3rd here in Winnipeg, which will be held at the Fort Garry Hotel on a Thursday. And then the Friday Night Awards, which will be November 4th, will be held at the MTS Center here in downtown Winnipeg. So over the course of two nights, we're expecting to hand out, like I said, about 22 awards. And it's going to be great. Like, a lot of new artists that are very enthusiastic about attending the awards, whether they get a nomination or not, will be in town. So we have a lot of supporters coming in from everywhere. So we're hoping for another great couple nights of music.
That was Derek McCorrister, Manager of Operations for the Aboriginal People's Choice Music Awards. You've been listening to Bomb Siddha with Jennifer Ashwasige. Bomb Siddha is an Aboriginal news magazine program which includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bomb Siddha means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bomseda.com. That's BAMOSEDA. And thanks for listening to Bomb Siddha.